Nobody said anything for a moment. Henry glanced up. His eyes without the glasses were blind, unwavering, strange. "Does Marion know about this?" he said. "No," said Cloak. "And I'd just as soon you didn't tell her, okay? Do you have any other reason for thinking this?" "No. Except where else could he be? And Marion told you about Rika Talheim seeing him at the bank on Wednesday?" "Yes." "That's kind of weird, but not really, not if you think about it. Say he went down to New York with $200, right? And talking like he had a lot more where that came from. These guys'll chop you up and put you in a garbage bag for $20. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they told him to go back home and close out his account and come back with all he had.
Bunny doesn't even have a bank account."
"That you know of," Cloak pointed out.
"You're perfectly right," said Henry.
"Can't you just call down there?" Charles said. "Who am I going to call? The guy's unlisted, and he doesn't hand out business cards, all right?"
"Then how do you get in touch with him?"
"I have to call a third guy."
"Then call him," said Henry calmly, putting the handkerchief back in his pocket and hooking the glasses back over his ears.
"They're not going to tell me anything."
"I thought they were such good chums of yours."
"What do you think?" said Cloak. "You think these people are running some kind of a scout troop down there? Are you kidding? These are real guys, doing real shit."
For one horrible instant, I thought that Francis was going to laugh aloud, but somehow he managed to turn it into a theatrical battery of coughs, hiding his face behind his hand. With barely a glance, Henry slapped him, hard, on the back.
"Then what do you suggest we do?" Camilla said. "I don't know. I'd like to get into his room," said Cloak. "See if he took a suitcase or anything."
"Isn't it locked?" Henry said.
"Yes. Marion tried to get security to open it for her, and they wouldn't do it."
Henry bit his lower lip.
"Well," he said slowly, "it wouldn't be so very hard to get in spite of that, would it?"
Cloak put out his cigarette and looked at Henry with new interest.
"No," he said, "it wouldn't."
"There's the ground floor window. The storm windows have been taken off.
I know I could handle the screens."
The two of them stared at each other.
"Maybe," Cloak said. "I should go down and try it now."
"We'll go with you."
"Man," said Cloak, "we can't all go."
I saw Henry cut his eyes at Charles. Charles, behind Cloak's back, acknowledged the glance.
"I'll go," he said suddenly, in a voice that was too loud, and tossed off the rest of his drink.
"Cloak, how on earth did you get mixed up in something like this?" Camilla said.
He laughed condescendingly.
"It's nothing," he said. "You have to meet these guys on their own ground. I don't let them give me shit or anything."
Inconspicuously, Henry slipped behind Cloak's chair to where Charles stood, and leaned over and whispered something in his ear. I saw Charles nod tersely.
"Not that they don't try to fuck with you," said Cloak. "But I know how they think. Now Bunny, he doesn't have a clue. He thinks it's some kind of a game, with $100 bills just lying on the ground waiting for some stupid kid to come along and pick 'em up."
By the time he stopped talking, Charles and Henry had completed whatever business they'd been discussing, and Charles had gone to the closet for his overcoat. Cloak reached for his sunglasses and stood up. He had a faint, dry smell of herbs, an echo of the pothead smell that always lingered in the dusty corridors of Durbanstall. Patchouli oil, clove cigarettes, incense. Charles wound the scarf around his neck. His expression was at once casual and turbulent. His eyes were distant and his mouth was steady, but his nostrils flared slightly with his breathing.
"Be careful," Camilla said.
She was talking to Charles, but Cloak turned and smiled.
"Piece of cake," he said.
She walked with them to the door. As soon as she shut it behind them, she turned around. Henry put a finger to his lips.
We listened to their footsteps going down the stairs, and were quiet until we heard Cloak's car start.
Henry went to the window and pulled aside a shabby lace curtain.
"They're gone," he said. "Henry, are you sure this is a good idea?" said Camilla. He shrugged, still looking at the street below. "I don't know," he said. "I had to play that one by ear."
"I wish you'd gone," said Camilla. "Why didn't you go with him?"
"I would have, but this is better."
"What did you say to him?"
"Well," said Henry, "it should be pretty obvious even to Cloak that Bunny isn't out of town. Everything he owns is in that room. Money, extra glasses, winter coat. Odds are that Cloak will want to leave and not say anything, but I told Charles to insist that they at least call Marion over for a look. If she sees, well, she doesn't know a thing about Cloak's problems and wouldn't care if she did. Unless I'm mistaken, she'll call the police, or Bunny's parents at the very least, and I doubt Cloak will be able to stop her."
"They won't find him today," said Francis. "It'll be dark in a couple of hours."
"Yes, but if we're lucky, they'll start looking first thing tomorrow."
"Do you think anyone will want to talk to us about it?"
"I don't know," said Henry abstractedly. "I don't know how they go about such things." A thin ray of sun struck the prisms of a candelabrum on the mantelpiece, throwing brilliant, trembling shards of light that were distorted by the slant of the dormer walls. All of a sudden, images from every crime movie I'd ever seen began to pop into my mind. The windowless room, the harsh lights and narrow hallways, images which did not seem so much theatrical or foreign as imbued with the indelible quality of memory, of experience lived. "Don't think, don't think," I told myself, looking fixedly at a bright, cold pool of sunlight soaking into the rug near my feet. Camilla tried to light a cigarette, but one match and then another went out. Henry took the box from her and struck one himself. It flared up high and strong, and she leaned close to it, one hand cupped around the flame and the other resting upon his wrist. The minutes crept by with a tortuous slowness. Camilla brought a bottle of whiskey into the kitchen, and we sat around the table playing euchre, Francis and Henry against Camilla and me. Camilla played well. This was her game, her favorite, but I wasn't a good partner, and we lost trick after trick to the others. The apartment was very still. Clink of glasses, ruffle of cards. Henry's sleeves were rolled above his elbows, and the sun glinted metallic off Francis's pince-nez. I did my best to concentrate on the game, but again and again I found myself staring, through the open door, at the clock on the mantel in the next room. It was one of those bizarre pieces of Victorian bric-a-brac that the twins were so fond of. A white china elephant with the clock balanced in a howdah, and a little black mahout in gilt turban and breeches to strike the hours. There was something diabolical about the mahout, and every time I looked up, I found him grinning at me in cheerful malice. I lost count of the score, lost count of the games. The room grew dim. Henry lay down his cards. "March," he said. "I'm sick of this," said Francis. "Where is he?" The clock ticked loudly, a jangling, arrhythmic tick. We sat in the fading light, the cards forgotten. Camilla took an apple from a bowl on the counter and sat in the window sill, eating it morosely and looking down at the street below. A fiery outline of twilight shone around her silhouette, burned red gold in her hair, grew diffuse in the fuzzy texture of the woolen skirt pulled carelessly about her knees. "Maybe something went wrong," Francis said. "Don't be ridiculous. What could go wrong?" "A million things. Maybe Charles lost his head or something." Henry gave him a fishy look. "Calm down," he said. "I don't know where you get all these Dostoyevsky sorts of ideas." Francis was about to reply when Camilla jumped up. "He's coming," she said. Henry stood up. "Where? Is he alone?" "Yes," said Camilla, running to the door. She ran down to meet him on the landing, and in a few moments the two of them were back. Charles's eyes were wild and his hair was disordered. He took off his coat, threw it on a chair, flung himself on the couch. "Somebody make me a drink," he said. "Is everything all right?" said Henry. "Yes." "What happened?" "Where's that drink?"
Impatiently, Henry splashed some whiskey in a dirty glass and shoved it at him. "Did it go well? Did the police come?" Charles took a long swallow, winced, and nodded. "Where's Cloak? At home?"
"I guess."
"Tell us everything from the first," Henry said. Charles finished the glass and set it down. His face was a damp, feverish red.
"You were right about that room," he said.
"What do you mean?" said Henry.
"It was eerie. Terrible. Bed unmade, dust everywhere, half an old Twinkie lying on his desk and ants crawling all over it. Cloak got scared and wanted to leave, but I called Marion before he could. She was there in a few minutes. Looked around, seemed kind of stunned, didn't say much. Cloak was very agitated."
"Did he tell her about the drug business?"
"No," said Charles. "He hinted at it more than once, but she wasn't paying much attention to him."
He looked up.
"You know, Henry," he said abruptly, "I think we made a bad mistake by not going down there first. We should have gone through that room ourselves before either of them ever saw it."
"Why do you say that?"
"Look what I found." He pulled a piece of paper from his pocket.
Henry took it from him quickly and looked it over.
"How did you get this?"
Charles shrugged.
"Luck. It was on top of his desk. I slipped it off the first chance I had."
I looked over Henry's shoulder. It was a Xerox of a page of the Hampton Examiner. Wedged between a column by the Home Extension Service and a chopped-off ad for garden hose, there was a small but conspicuous headline: "Mysterious Death in Battenkill County."
Battenkill County Sheriff Department, along with Hampton Police, are still investigating the brutal November 12 homicide of Harry Ray McCree. The mutilated corpse of Mr. McCree, a poultry farmer and former member of the Egg Producers Association of Vermont, was found upon his Mechanicsville farm. Robbery did not appear to be a motive, and though Mr. McCree was known to have several enemies, both in the chicken and egg business and in Battenkill County at large, none of these are suspects in the slaying.
Horrified, I leaned closer. The word "mutilated" had electrified me. It was the only thing I could see on the page. But Henry had turned the paper over and begun to study the other side.
"Well," he said, "at least this isn't a photocopy of a clipping. Odds are he did this at the library, from the school's copy."
"I hope you're right," said Charles, "but that doesn't mean it's the only copy."
Henry put the paper in the ashtray and struck the match. When he touched it to the edge, a bright red seam crawled up the side, then licked suddenly over the whole thing. The words were illumined for a moment before they curled and darkened.
"Well," he said, "it's too late now. At least you got this one. What happened next?"
"Well, Marion left. She went next door to Putnam House and came back with a friend."
"Who?"
"I don't know her. Jutta or Ursula or something. One of those Swedish-looking girls who wears fisherman sweaters all the time. Anyway, she had a look around, too, and Cloak was just sitting there on the bed smoking a cigarette and looking like his stomach hurt him. And finally she, this Jutta or whatever, suggested we go upstairs and tell Bunny's house chairperson."
Francis started laughing. At Hampton, the house chair people were who you complained to if your storm windows didn't work, or if someone was playing their stereo too loud.
"Well, it's a good thing she did, or we might still be standing there," said Charles. "It was that loud, red-haired girl who wears hiking boots all the time.
What's her name? Bryony Dillard?"
"Yes," I said. "Beside being a house chairperson and a vigorous member of the student council, she was also the president of a leftist group off campus, and was always trying to mobilize the youth of Hampton in the face of crushing indifference."
"Well, she barged in and got the show on the road," said Charles. "Took our names, asked a bunch of questions, herded Bunny's neighbors into the hall and asked them questions, called student services, then security. Security said they would send somebody over." He lit a cigarette. but it really wasn't their jurisdiction, a student disappearance, and that she should call the police. "Will you get me another drink?" he said, turning abruptly to Camilla. "And they came?" Charles, cigarette balanced between his first and middle fingers, wiped the sweat from his forehead with the heel of his hand. "Yes," he said. "Two of them, and a couple of security guards as well." "What did they do?" said Henry. "The security guards didn't do anything, but the policemen were actually kind of efficient. One of them looked around the room while the other herded everybody in the hall and started asking questions."
"What kind of questions?"
"Who'd seen him last and where? How long he'd been gone? Where he might be? It all sounds pretty obvious, but that was the first time anyone had even asked."
"Did Cloak say anything?" Henry said.
"Not much. It was very confused, a lot of people around, most of them dying to tell what they knew, which was nothing. No one paid any attention to me at all. This lady who'd come down from student services kept trying to butt in, acting very officious and saying it wasn't a police matter, that the school would handle it. Finally, one of the policemen got mad. 'Look,' he said, 'what's the matter with you people? This boy's been missing for a solid week, and nobody's even mentioned it till now. This is serious business, and if you want my 2 cents, I think the school may be at fault.' Well, that really got the lady from student services going, and then, all of a sudden, the policeman in the room came out with Bunny's wallet. Everything got very quiet. There was $200 in it, and all of Bunny's ID. The policeman who'd found it said, 'I think we'd better contact this boy's family.' Everyone started whispering. The lady from student services got very white and said she'd go up to her office and get Bunny's file immediately. The policeman went with her. By this time, the hall was absolutely mobbed. They'd trickled in from outdoors and were hanging around to see what was going on. The first policeman told them to go home and mind their own business, and Cloak slid away in the confusion. Before he left, he pulled me aside and told me again not to mention that drug business. 'I hope you waited until you were told you could leave,' said Henry. 'I did. It wasn't much longer. The policeman wanted to talk to Marion, and he told me and this Yuta we could go home once he'd taken our names and stuff. That was about an hour ago.' 'Then why are you just getting back?' 'I'm coming to that. I didn't want to run into anybody on the way home, so I cut across the back of campus, down behind the faculty offices. That was a big mistake. I hadn't even got to the Birch Grove when that troublemaker from student services, the lady that started the fight, saw me from out the window of the dean's office and called for me to come in.' 'What was she doing in the dean's office?' said Henry. 'Using the Watts line. They had Bunny's father on the telephone. He was yelling at everybody, threatening to sue. The dean of studies was trying to calm him down, but Mr. Corcoran kept asking to talk to someone he knew. They'd tried to get you on another line, Henry, but you weren't home.'
'Had he asked to talk to me?'
Apparently. They were about to send someone up to the Lyceum for Julian, but then this lady saw me out the window. There were about 1 million people there. The policeman, the dean's secretary, 4 or 5 people from down the hall, that nutty lady who works in records. Next door in the admissions office, somebody was trying to get hold of the president. And there were some teachers hanging around, too. I guess the dean of studies was in the middle of a conference when the lady from student services came bursting in with the policeman. Your friend was there, Richard. Dr. Rowland. Anyway, the crowd parted when I came in, and the dean of studies handed me the telephone. Mr. Corcoran calmed down when he realized who I was, got all confidential, and asked me if this wasn't some type of frat stunt."
"Oh, God," said Francis.
Charles looked at him out of the corner of his eye. "He asked about you."
"Where's the old carrot top?" he said.
"What else did he say?" said Henry.
"He was very nice. Asked about you all, really. Said to tell everybody he said hi."
There was a long, uncomfortable pause. Henry bit his lower lip and went to the liquor cabinet to pour himself a drink.
"Did anything," he said, "come up about that bank business?"
"Yes. Marion gave them the girl's name. "By the way," when he looked up, his eyes were distracted, blank, "I forgot to tell you earlier, but Marion gave your name to the police. Yours too, Francis."
"Why?" said Francis, alarmed. "What for?"
"Who were his friends? They wanted to know."
"But why me?"
"Calm down, Francis." The light in the room was gone. The skies were lilac-colored, and the snowy streets had a surreal, lunar glow. Henry turned on the lamp.
"Do you think they'll start looking tonight?" Francis said.
"They'll look for him, certainly," said Henry. "Whether they'll look in the right place is something else." No one said anything for a moment. Charles, thoughtfully, rattled the ice in his glass. "You know," he said, "we've done a terrible thing."
"We had to, Charles, as we have all discussed."
"I know, but I can't stop thinking about Mr. Corcoran. The holidays we spent at his house. And he was so sweet on the telephone."
"We're all a lot better off."
"Some of us are, you mean?"
Henry smiled acidly. "Oh, I don't know," he said.
"Pelaeubus megas hein aide."
This was something to the effect that, in the underworld, a great ox costs only a penny, but I knew what he meant, and in spite of myself I laughed. There was a tradition among the ancients that things were very cheap in hell. When Henry left, he offered to drive me back to school. It was late, and when we pulled up behind the dormitory, I asked him if he wanted to come to Commons and have some dinner. We stopped in the post office so Henry could check his mail. He went to his mailbox only about every 3 weeks, so there was quite a stack waiting for him. He stood by the trash can, going through it indifferently, throwing half the envelopes away unopened. Then he stopped.
"What is it?"
He laughed. "Look in your mailbox. It's a faculty questionnaire. Julian's up for review." They were closing the dining hall by the time we arrived, and the janitors had already started to mop the floor. The kitchen was closed, too, so I went to ask for some peanut butter and bread while Henry made himself a cup of tea. The main dining room was deserted. We sat at a table in the corner, our reflections mirrored in the black of the plate glass windows. Henry took out a pen and began to fill out Julian's evaluation. I looked at my own copy while I ate my sandwich. The questions were ranked from 1, poor, to 5, excellent.
"Is this faculty member prompt?
Well prepared?
Ready to offer help outside the classroom?"
Henry, without the slightest pause, had gone down the list and circled all 5s. Now I saw him writing the number 19 in a blank.
"What's that for?" I said.
"The number of classes I've taken with Julian," he said, without looking up.
"You've taken 19 classes with Julian?"
"Well, that's tutorials and everything," he said, irritated. For a moment there was no sound except the scratching of Henry's pen and the distant crash of dish racks in the kitchen. "Does everybody get these, or just us?" I said.
"Just us. I wonder why they even bother."
"For their records, I suppose." He had turned to the last page, which was mostly blank. "Please elaborate here on any additional compliments or criticisms you may have of this teacher. Extra sheets of paper may be attached if necessary." His pen hovered over the paper. Then he folded the sheet and pushed it aside.
"What?" I said. "Aren't you going to write anything?"
Henry took a sip of his tea.
"How," he said, "can I possibly make the Dean of Studies understand that there is a divinity in our midst?"
After dinner, I went back to my room. I dreaded the thought of the night ahead, but not for the reasons one might expect, that I was worried about the police, or that my conscience bothered me, or anything of the sort. Quite the contrary. By that time, by some purely subconscious means, I had developed a successful mental block about the murder and everything pertaining to it. I talked about it in select company, but seldom thought of it when alone. What I did experience when alone was a sort of general neurotic horror, a common attack of nerves and self-loathing magnified to the power of 10. Every cruel or fatuous thing I'd ever said came back to me with an amplified clarity, no matter how I talked to myself or jerked my head to shake the thoughts away. Old insults and guilts and embarrassments stretching clear back to childhood. The crippled boy I'd made fun of, the Easter chick I'd squeezed to death, paraded before me one by one, in vivid and mordant splendor. I tried to work on Greek, but it wasn't much good. I would look up a word in the lexicon only to forget it when I turned to write it down. My noun cases, my verb forms, had left me utterly. Around midnight, I went downstairs and called the twins. Camilla answered the phone. She was sleepy, a little drunk, and getting ready for bed. "Tell me a funny story," I said. "I can't think of any funny stories." "Any story," I said. "Cinderella? The Three Bears?" "Tell me something that happened to you when you were little," I said. So she told me about the only time she remembered seeing her father before he and her mother were killed. It was snowing, she said, and Charles was asleep, and she was standing in her crib looking out the window. Her father was out in the yard in an old gray sweater, throwing snowballs against the side of the fence. "It must have been about the middle of the afternoon," she said. "I don't know what he was doing there. All I know is that I saw him, and I wanted to go out so bad, and I was trying to climb out of my crib and go to him. Then my grandmother came in and put the bars up so I couldn't get out, and I started to cry. My Uncle Hillary, he was my grandmother's brother, he lived with us when we were little, came in the room and saw me crying. 'Poor little girl,' he said. He rummaged around in his pockets, and finally he found a tape measure and gave it to me to play with."
"A tape measure?"
"Yes, you know, the ones that snap in when you push a button. Charles and I used to fight over it all the time. It's still at home somewhere."
Late the next morning, I woke with an unpleasant start to a knock at my door. I opened it to find Camilla, who looked as if she'd dressed in a hurry. She came in and locked the door behind her while I stood blinking sleepily in my bathrobe. "Have you been outside today?" she said. A spider of anxiety crawled up the back of my neck. I sat down on the side of my bed. "No," I said. "Why?"
"I don't know what's going on," she said. "The police are talking to Charles and Henry, and I don't even know where Francis is."
"What?"
"A policeman came by and asked for Charles around 7 this morning. He didn't say what he wanted. Charles got dressed, and they went off together, and then at 8 I got a call from Henry. He asked if I'd mind if he was a little late this morning, and I asked what he was talking about because we hadn't planned to meet. 'Oh, thanks,' he said. 'I knew you'd understand. The police are here about Bunny, you see, and they want to ask some questions.'"
"I'm sure it'll be all right." She ran a hand through her hair, in an exasperated gesture reminiscent of her brother.
"But it's not just that," she said. "There are people all over the place. Reporters, police. It's like a madhouse."
"Are they looking for him?"
"I don't know what they're doing. They seem to be headed toward Mount Cataract."
"Maybe we should leave campus for a while." Her pale, silvery glance skittered anxiously around my room.
"Maybe," she said. "Get dressed and we'll decide what to do."
I was in the bathroom scraping a quick razor over my face when Judy Poovey came in and rushed over so fast I cut my cheek.
"Richard," she said, her hand on my arm, "have you heard?"
I touched my face and looked at the blood on my fingertips, then glanced at her, annoyed. "Heard what?"
"About Bunny," she said, her voice hushed and her eyes wide. I stared at her, not knowing what she was going to say. "Jack Teitelbaum told me," she said. "Cloak was talking to him about it last night. I never heard of anybody just, like, vanishing. It's too weird. And Jack was saying, well, if they haven't found him by now... I mean, I'm sure he's all right and everything," she said, when she saw the way I was looking at her.
I couldn't think of anything to say.
"If you want to stop by or anything, I'll be at home," she said.
"Sure.
I mean," she said, "if you want to talk or something, I'm always there. Just stop by."
"Thanks," I said, a little too abruptly.
She looked up at me, her eyes large with compassion, with understanding of the solitude and incivility of grief. "It'll be okay," she said, giving my arm a squeeze, and then she left, pausing in the door for a sorrowful backwards glance. Despite what Camilla had said, I was unprepared for the riot of activity outside. The parking lot was full, and people from Hampton Town were everywhere, factory workers mostly, from the looks of them, some with lunchboxes, others with children, beating the ground with sticks and making their way toward Mount Cataract in broad, straggling lines as students milled about and looked at them curiously. There were policemen, deputies, a state trooper or two. On the lawn, parked beside a couple of official-looking vehicles, was a remote radio station hookup, a concessions truck, and a van from Action News 12. "What are all these people doing here?" I said.
"Look," she said, "is that Francis?"
Far away, in the busy multitude, I saw a flash of red hair, the conspicuous line of muffled throat and black greatcoat. Camilla stuck up her hand and yelled to him. He shouldered his way through a bunch of cafeteria workers who had come outside to see what was going on. He was smoking a cigarette. There was a newspaper tucked under his arm. "Hello," he said. "Can you believe this?"
"What's going on?"
"A treasure hunt."
"What?"
"The Corcorans put up a big reward in the night," said Francis. "All the factories in Hampton are closed. Anybody want some coffee? I have a dollar." We picked our way to the concessions truck, through a sparse, gloomy gathering of janitors and maintenance men.
"Three coffees, two with milk, please," said Francis to the fat woman behind the counter.
"No milk, just Cremora."
"Well, then, just black, I guess."
He turned to us.
"Have you seen the paper this morning?"
It was a late edition of the Hampton Examiner. In a column on the first page was a blurry, recent photograph of Bunny, and under it this caption: "Police, kin, seek youth, 24, missing in Hampton."
24? I said, startled. The twins and I were 20 years old, and Henry and Francis were 21.
"He failed a grade or two in elementary school," said Camilla.
"Ah."
Sunday afternoon, Edmund Corcoran, a Hampton College student known to his family and friends as Bunny, attended a campus party, which he apparently left sometime in the middle of the afternoon in order to meet his girlfriend Marion Barnbridge of Rye, New York, also a student at Hampton. That was the last that anyone has seen of Bunny Corcoran. The concerned Barnbridge, along with friends of Corcoran's, yesterday alerted state and local police, who put out a missing persons bulletin. Today the search begins in the Hampton area. The missing youth is described as...
See page 5.
"Are you finished?" I asked Camilla.
"Yes, turn the page. Being 6 feet 3 inches tall, weighing 190 pounds, with sandy blonde hair and blue eyes. He wears glasses, and when last seen was wearing a gray tweed sports coat, khaki pants, and a yellow rain slicker."
"Here's your coffee, Richard," said Francis, turning gingerly with a cup in either hand. At St. Jerome's Preparatory School in College Falls, Massachusetts, Corcoran was active in varsity sports, lettering in hockey, lacrosse, and crew, and leading his football team, the Wolverines, to a state championship when he captained during senior year. At Hampton, Corcoran served as a volunteer fire marshal. He studied literature and languages, with a concentration in classics, and was described by fellow students as a scholar.
"Ha," said Camilla.
Cloak Rayburn, a school friend of Corcoran's and one of those who first notified police, said that Corcoran is, quote, "a real straight guy, definitely not mixed up in drugs or anything like that." Yesterday afternoon, after growing suspicious, he broke into Corcoran's dormitory room and subsequently notified police.
"That's not right," Camilla said. "He didn't call them."
"There's not a word about Charles," said Francis.
"Thank God," she said, in Greek.
Corcoran's parents, MacDonald and Catherine Corcoran of Shady Brook, Connecticut, arrive in Hampton today to assist in the search for the youngest of their 5 children. See A Family Prays, page 10. In a telephone interview, Mr. Corcoran, who is president of the Bingham Bank and Trust Company and a member of the board of directors of the First National Bank of Connecticut, said, "There's not much we can do down here. We want to assist if we can." He said that he had spoken to his son by telephone a week before the disappearance and had noticed nothing unusual. Of her son, Catherine Corcoran said, "Edmund is a very family-oriented type person. If anything was wrong, I know he would have told Mac or myself." A reward of $50,000 is being offered for information leading to the whereabouts of Edmund Corcoran, provided through contributions from the Corcoran family, the Bingham Bank and Trust Company, and the Highland Heights Lodge of the Loyal Order of the Moose. The wind was blowing. With Camilla's help, I folded the newspaper and handed it back to Francis. $50,000, I said. That's a lot of money. "And you wonder why you see all these people from Hampton Town up here this morning?" said Francis, taking a sip of his coffee. "Gosh, it's cold out here." We turned and started back toward Commons. Camilla said to Francis, "You know about Charles and Henry, don't you?" "Well, they told Charles they might want to talk to him, didn't they?" "But Henry?" "I wouldn't waste my time worrying about Henry." Commons was overheated and surprisingly empty. The three of us sat on a clammy, black vinyl couch and drank our coffee. People drifted in and out, bringing blasts of cold air from outdoors. Some of them came over to ask if there was any news. Judd, Party Pig McKenna, as vice president of the student council, came over with his empty paint can to ask if we would like to donate to an emergency search fund. Between us, we contributed $1 in change. We were talking to Georges Laforgue, who was telling us enthusiastically and at great length about a similar disappearance at Brandeis, when suddenly, from nowhere, Henry appeared behind him. Laforgue turned. "Oh," he said coldly, when he saw who it was. Henry inclined his head slightly. "Bonjour, Monsieur Laforgue," he said. "Quel plaisir de vous revoir." Laforgue, with a flourish, took a handkerchief from his pocket and blew his nose for what seemed about 5 minutes. Then, refolding the handkerchief into fussy little squares, he turned his back on Henry and resumed his story. It happened, in this case, that the student had simply gone off to New York City on the bus without telling anybody. "And this boy, Birdie, is it?"
"Bunny."
"Yes. This boy has been away for far less long. He will appear again, of his own accord, and everyone will feel very foolish."
He lowered his voice.
"I believe that the school is afraid of a lawsuit, and that perhaps is why they lost their sense of proportion, no? Please do not repeat me."
"Of course not."
"My position is delicate with the dean, you understand."
"I'm a bit tired," Henry said later, in the car. "But there's nothing to worry about."
"What did they want to know?"
"Nothing much. How long had I known him? Was he acting strangely? Did I know any reason why he might have decided to leave school?" "Of course, he has been acting strangely the last few months, and I said so. But I also said I hadn't seen very much of him lately, which is true." He shook his head. "Honestly, 2 hours. I don't know if I could have made myself go through with this if I'd known what nonsense we were letting ourselves in for." We stopped by the twins' apartment and found Charles asleep on the couch, sprawled on his stomach in his shoes and overcoat, one arm dangling over the edge so that 3 or 4 inches of wrist and an equal amount of cuff were exposed. He woke with a start. His face was puffy, and the ridged pattern from the sofa cushions was printed deeply on his cheek. "How did it go?" said Henry. Charles sat up a bit and rubbed his eyes. "All right, I guess," he said. "They wanted me to sign something that said what happened yesterday." Henry said, "They visited me as well."
"Really? What'd they want?"
"The same questions."
"Were they nice to you?"
"Not particularly."
"God, they were so nice to me down at the police station. They even gave me breakfast, coffee and jelly donuts." This
was a Friday, which meant no classes, and that Julian was not in Hampton, but at home. His house was not far from where we were, halfway to Albany, where we'd driven to have pancakes at a truck stop. And after lunch, Henry suggested, quite out of the blue, that we drive by and see if he was there. I had never been in Julian's house, had never even seen it, though I assumed the rest of them had been there 100 times. Actually, Henry being, of course, the notable exception, Julian did not allow many visitors. This was not so surprising as it sounds. He kept a gentle but firm distance between himself and his students. And though he was much more fond of us than teachers generally are of their pupils, it was not, even with Henry, a relationship of equals, and our classes with him ran more along the lines of benevolent dictatorship than democracy. "I am your teacher," he once said, "because I know more than you do." Though on a psychological level his manner was almost painfully intimate, superficially it was businesslike and cold. He refused to see anything about any of us except our most engaging qualities, which he cultivated and magnified to the exclusion of all our tedious and less desirable ones. While I felt a delicious pleasure in adjusting myself to fit this attractive, if inaccurate, image, and, eventually, in finding that I had more or less become the character which for a long time I had so skillfully played, there was never any doubt that he did not wish to see us in our entirety, or see us, in fact, in anything other than the magnificent roles he had invented for us. Genis gratus corpore glabellus, arte multiscius et fortuna opulentus. Smooth-cheeked, soft-skinned, well-educated, and rich. It was his odd blindness, I think, to all problems of a personal nature, which made him able at the end to transmute even Bunny's highly substantive troubles into spiritual ones. I knew then, and know now, virtually nothing about Julian's life outside of the classroom, which is perhaps what lent such a tantalizing breath of mystery to everything he said or did. No doubt his personal life was as flawed as anyone's, but the only side of himself he ever allowed us to see was polished to such a high gloss of perfection that it seemed when he was away from us he must lead an existence too rarefied for me to even imagine. So, naturally, I was vastly curious to see where he lived. It was a large stone house, set on a hill, miles off the main road, and nothing but trees and snow as far as one could see. Imposing enough, but not half so gothic and monstrous as Francis's. I had heard marvelous tales of his garden, also of the inside of his house, attic vases, Meissen porcelain, paintings by Alma Tadema and Frith. But the garden was covered with snow, and Julian, apparently, was not at home. At least he didn't answer the door. Henry looked back down the hill to where we waited in the car. He reached into his pocket for a piece of paper and scribbled a note that he folded and wedged in the crack of the door.